This is Pacifica Radio Network special coverage of Egypt and environs. I'm Robert Knight in New York. And our guest is Gail Tverberg. She is an expert and analyst of petroleum economics and finance, also known to many as Gail the Actuary, where she publishes on The Oil Drum and is a frequent author on Our Finite World. And as the events began to cascade in Egypt, Gail was the author of a seminal paper called What's Behind Egypt's Problems that took a different look at why there is perhaps the turmoil that there is today. And at the root of the politics, there appears to be economics. Gail, in your article, you say that starting at about 2010 or 2011, Egypt will change from an oil-exporting nation to an oil-importing nation. What are the implications of that in the study that you have done?
Well, when you're an oil-exporting nation, you're taking money in with all of this oil you're selling, and you can use that money to provide subsidies for food or oil or whatever. And once you change to be an importer, instead of getting money to provide these subsidies, you also have the problem of having to go out and buy the oil yourself. So you've gone from it being a net positive to your financial situation to a net negative.
How do you calculate this tipping point for the implosion of the Egyptian oil economy?
Well, I think, you know, there's a couple of different organizations that put together data, and they combine things a little bit differently. And the ones that look at pure oil say that they've already passed that tipping point. And the ones that include, I think, the natural gas liquids, they would put it off a year different or so. But it's really, I think, has by 2011 already occurred.
There would be a problem if Egypt becomes no longer an oil exporter. What happens to the oil that is remaining to be produced that is used internally? How is that allocated, and what implications can we draw from the consumption and use of that amount?
Well, historically, Egypt has provided subsidies of the oil, and so that's allowed it to be shared somewhat equitably, but of course, what happens is that you end up with a lot of cars and not necessarily the best use of that oil. If the amount of oil is going down, there will be less, and it will become more and more difficult to share equitably. Under normal circumstances, the prices will rise, and it will be priced too high for the poorer members of society.
Whether for export or for domestic use, over the long span of time, what does the curve of Egyptian oil production look like?
I think we can expect that the amount of oil that they're going to be producing is going to be going down on average each year. It may not be exactly that way, but probably over the next 15 or 20 years, it will decline very substantially.
And why would that be?
Well, what happens is that, there is a finite amount of oil in each particular place in the ground where it's found. When you pull it out, there's some easy oil that comes out first. Sometimes with more advanced techniques, you can get more out. But after a point, it's like drinking water from a glass. It gets to be all gone. It kind of goes down slowly because what you're really pulling out is a mixture of oil and water, and the mixture switches towards being more and more water over time, so it doesn't just drop off suddenly.
So the difficulty of getting it and the purity, the freshness, as it were, declines over time.
Right. You end up spending more and more money just for the separation process, because in some situations in the United States, we're taking out this mixture that's 99% water and 1% oil, and have to process all of this water, which is not the kind of water you would just dump down the drain anywhere, and to get this little bit of oil.
Does Egypt process much or most of the raw petroleum that it extracts, or does it have to send it out and get it back, and does that involve additional costs?
Egypt has a big refinery operation set up. And so it does have plenty, well, I would have to check and see exactly how much it comes out to be, but it does have its own refinery set up, and that's one of the sources that it's had for funds over the years.
What is the situation with natural gas? Does that provide any kind of a buffer or a bailout for the declining exports and financial crisis inside Egypt?
Well, a few years ago, Egypt was able to ramp up its natural gas production and start being an exporter, but that amount of exports has leveled off, and of course their own consumption is going up, so it may be that the amount of exports actually starts going down fairly soon. It provides some buffer. But natural gas is normally a much cheaper product than oil, so it's hard to get as much buffering as you do from the oil.
When we talk about the increasing difficulty of each additional ounce of extraction and the inevitability of a decline in production for a given set of reserves, it brings to mind a phrase that is of some controversy and that perhaps not enough people understand, and that is the concept called peak oil. Is that a factor in the Egyptian petro-economical crisis?
Well, I think in each location, there is a certain amount of oil that can be extracted before it goes into decline. So in that sense, peak oil is a factor. To me, on a worldwide basis, or wherever, it's really a financial issue. It's how much can economies afford to pay for oil. There's a maximum level before it sends the economies into recession. I think that the false belief so many have is that just because we see the possibility of extracting oil in many different places around the world, and in many more difficult locations, that oil really will be extracted. What in fact happens is that some of that oil is really too difficult to get. It takes more than a barrel of oil to get the oil out, especially when you consider all the costs involved. So the peak oil issue is really a price issue.
Our guest is Gail Teverberg, also known as Gail the Actuary, the author of a study called What's Behind Egypt's Problems. And you go beyond just the oil and economic analysis. You say that there's yet another stress on the stability or growth of aspirations among the Egyptian population for the simple fact that it is increasing. How does that factor in?
Well, there's so many more people that becomes an issue when you're trying to share a smaller amount of resources. We have the oil and gas resources they're trying to share. We also have the Nile River and the arable land along the Nile River. As you have more people, there's less space for farming along the Nile River, so that causes the need for more food imports.
Food imports means what? Does it mean wheat, and is that subject to the same kinds of economic vulnerability as the rest of the internal needs of the Egyptian population?
Well, certainly wheat is, you know, a very major staple in Egypt, and I believe Egypt is the world's largest importer of wheat. That becomes a real issue because the prices for wheat are very high now. The harvest wasn't the best this last year, but even apart from that, there has been a problem with wheat harvests and grain harvests in general not rising all that quickly, but at the same time, the needs of the world continue to rise.
We see among a younger generation greater education, higher aspirations, and one of the complaints that we have heard is that the future is insecure, that the guarantee of comfort, of education, of other social improvements may not be in the cards in the future with this economic crisis and decline in subsidies and so on. How do you think that sociological factor plays into the crisis we're witnessing today?
Well, I think when there's hope, then, you know, you're willing to give leaders a little bit more slack than when everything looks kind of depressing. I think young people around the world today are running into this, that they're finding it harder and harder to find jobs. You know, that things just aren't as good as back when some of us in the older generation, the parents' generation, went through. We found it fairly easy to find jobs.
What do you see as a possible, if not solution, source of relief from Egypt? Will there be a world aid program to subsidize the imports that are insufficiently subsidized by the Egyptian economy itself? How do you see any economic way out of the increasing stresses that lead to social instability?
It's hard to see a solution of that sort. The problem being that everybody else is running into the same kind of problem with the oil being in shorter and shorter supply. You know, as there are more bidders for what has really been a constant or close to constant level of oil since the end of 2004 or beginning of 2005, what we find is that any increase by one part of the world means a decrease for others. And, of course, China now is getting more.
We're speaking with analyst and actuary Gail Tverberg. I'm Robert Knight. This is Pacific Radio Network. One other factor, Egypt does stand strategically located at the transfer point between the Mediterranean and the Red Sea with the Suez Canal at the Sinai Peninsula. That would seem like an evergreen breadwinner. Or does that provide any hope for Egyptian salvation?
Well, I'm sure it gives them some income. I think the problem is that if there is less oil or transferred back and forth, the income from that will decline too as world exports decline.
Gail Tverberg is an expert and analyst of petroleum economics and finance.
The soul gatherer, protect their people, their sacred birth. Not as first, but where you belong, where many old spirits dance your song. Piece of paper, a devil's lie. For in this you let my people die to return a land of light. Through the earth, the sky will pay the price. Through the earth, the sky, the soul will rise. Yeah. You have no spirit, no light, no God. You are the death from graves you rob. Piece of paper, a devil's lie. For this you let my people die. To return a land of lies. Through the earth, the sky will pay the price. Through the earth, the sky will soul the price. Go on, oh, 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 oh
Gail, I know that you are working on other analyses in regard to the emblematic problems we're witnessing in Egypt, the economic underpinning that seems simultaneous with social protest. And the elephant in the room, the question I would present to you today, beyond your study of what's behind Egypt's problems, is this. Even as we speak, there is ferocious turmoil in the nation of Libya. It is one of the world's largest exporters of oil. And there has been what may be a de facto partition with the Fezzan region in the east versus that of Tripoli. There are calls for international evacuations as we speak. Some of the oil companies and explorers are withdrawing their personnel. How is the situation of Libya, which up until this moment has been an oil exporter, different from that of Egypt?
Well, I think one thing about Libya is it's a richer country, so it doesn't really have quite as much problems with, say, maintaining subsidies because it does have theoretically plenty of oil to export. But I think the situation here is that the exports are really more at risk because of all of the different kinds of things that are happening, the possibility of partition of the country. I know I read one report of one particular oil installation being taken over by some rebel group. And, of course, with these oil companies leaving, it leaves the infrastructure more unprotected. So there's a real chance that something could happen. If someone should light some of them on fire, they make a very spectacular scene, and people could do it just for that reason.
It's my understanding that a large portion of the oil, maybe even approaching half, goes to Europe, particularly to Italy and Germany, among other locations. If I recall correctly, Libya has been producing on average about 1.75 million barrels a day. What if Benghazi did seek to become another Kurdistan, that is, an oil autonomous region within what we have traditionally thought of as a nation? What is the global impact of the loss of that oil production?
Well, I guess the question is really if it's a loss of that production or not. You know, if they can actually keep it up and they can actually put it on the market, or they can use it to offset, you know, some other production elsewhere, then you don't have a real problem. But I was figuring exports are 1.5 million barrels a day, and we were to lose that, it would send the world oil prices up, especially if OPEC cannot replace them elsewhere. I know OPEC has claimed that they have the capability of just increasing their production elsewhere and that making up for the short supply, but they seem to be very long on talk and very short on action.
That would be perhaps a reference to Saudi Arabia's claim that it could take up the slack for any missing production on that magnitude?
Yes, I've read that they're talking about making up the slack. And I think right now the reports are that the slack is, you know, much less than 1.5 million barrels a day.
But at the same time, we are hearing from the WikiLeaked State Department cables that the Saud family apparently was misrepresenting the amount of reserves that they have by as much as 40%. Do you think that there could be any hidden surprises in the reality of the production ability?
I think that people who are expecting that Saudi Arabia can easily ramp up its production are probably being too optimistic. I think that Saudi Arabia has been producing for a very long time. I believe it's 60 years. And at some point, this oil starts getting depleted and starts going down. I think, you know, they're doing a lot of work to add more production, but I think to a significant extent, all they're doing is replacing lost production just from decline. So I think there's going to be, you know, while some of those making forecasts are expecting that Saudi Arabia can increase its production in the future, I don't think those increases are going to be there, and we may in fact see decreases.
Gail, as we speak, with the uncertainty about developments in Libya, the oil exporter, there has already been a precipitous, perhaps an overreaction in the increase of crude oil prices. The last time I checked, it was the sudden increase was somewhere between 5% and 10%. And there are various predictions. What do you think can be the maximum excursion there? What do you expect from the apparent increase in the price of oil globally?
You know, it's hard to tell. As long as it stays in the particular region that we're talking about right now, maybe, you know, the 5 or 10% is, we've seen what we're going to get. But I think if we start seeing this spread to other countries, you know, Iran is a big exporter, for example, or certainly Saudi Arabia, we could see higher increases. I don't see, though, that the price is going to stay, you know, it's not going to go up to $147 a barrel and stay there, though, because what it's going to do is cause recession. It will come back down fairly quickly, and the people who assume that oil shortages cause high prices are going to be kind of surprised when they discover what it really causes is recession.
For not only those in the United States, but for economies around the world, what kind of jeopardy or caution do you see in the signposts up ahead?
Well, I think there's a real possibility we could see another oil spike followed by more recession and more debt defaults.
Debt defaults? How so?
Well, what happens is that as oil prices go up, it takes money away. It takes it, you know, it reduces the tax revenue, for one thing, that the governments are getting. And so it makes it harder for them to pay their, you know, obligations. I think we've already seen that as it played out the last time around. But it, for an individual person who is buying a homeowner, you know, a person who is commuting and has to pay for a higher price for oil for his car, is paying for a higher price for food, he has less discretionary income. And occasional people, when they have less discretionary income, aren't going to be able to pay the loans that they have outstanding. So you're going to see a rise in debt defaults, both for individual people and for governments.
Do you suppose this could have any impact on a global military policy? One of the facts that I've been taken by is the claim that the Pentagon is the single largest burner of gasoline, of fuel, and of greenhouse gas production, and that factor must be similar for other nations with global military commitments. And do you think that those petroleum-related economies could be affected by any possible disruption in production?
Well, I think that some of these military organizations are going to have to stop and think, if no other reason, the fact that taxes are coming out to be so much short of expenditures for so many countries, they need to find a place to cut back somewhere. And as oil prices go higher, then they need to think about the military, too, as to don't they need to make cutbacks in what they're doing in their overseas presence. I don't know that this has really happened, but you would think that they're going to have to start thinking about that.
That's quite some thought. You're speaking with Gail Tverberg, an actuary who has studied the impact of petroleum in relation to global economies and finance. And Gail, I'd like to just take a moment to give you the stage, give you the floor, to leave us with some thoughtful wisdom about this whole economic, chemical, and geological syndrome.
Well, I think it's kind of a worrisome period that we're going through, and I wish I could see a nice outcome coming out of it, but I'm afraid that the situation is that there are a lot more chances for a downside than for an upside.
Where could people follow your work?
I write, my own blog site is called Our Finite World, ourfiniteworld.com. Also, I write on the Oil Drum, and some of my writings are in other locations, too, like on the Association for the Study of Peak Oil, the USA. I write articles for some of their newsletters.
It's been both an honor and a clarity to have you with us today. I thank you so much for your insight and analysis.
Well, thank you.
This is Pacifica Radio Network. That's Gail Tverberg. I'm Robert Knight in New York.